keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves. What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network, 855-75-CIVIC. We're talking about the money today in oh so many iterations and forms, because it's usually all about the money. And here's what. There's hope here. I ended yesterday's show with hope. I'm going to end today's show with hope. You're going to have to hang on. But most of the MAGA far right, they're doing it because they think they're going to get rich off of it. And some of them are. Very rich. But most of it's defined by lying, gaslighting, basically accusing anyone who's in opposition to you of doing the very thing that you're doing. Rinse, wash, repeat. I've been calling it the gaslighting of America. And the thing that breaks my heart is that most of the money that's lining the pockets of these liars and serial manipulators and the psychological warfare against middle class folks like you and I is basically being paid by either taxpayers or the unwitting donor, the donor who has been duped. It's all a fraud. Joe Biden won the 2020 election. If Donald Trump is as rich as he says he is, he shouldn't need anybody else to pay his legal fees. If what Giuliani said was true, he wouldn't have been assessed damages nearly in excess of $150 million. If he was so righteous, why wouldn't Donald Trump pay that for him? It's all about the money. And we're not just going to talk about local, national flavored money. We're going to talk about local money today, too, with one of my favorite people, the executive director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Henken. If you don't know what the WPF is, you're going to want to keep it locked in. Rob's going to talk about things that are important to every single one of us as Wisconsinites, which are our parks and our local governments, whether you're in the northernmost part, up in Ashland, the Apostle Islands, west to La Crosse, east to Gills Rock, south to Racine, Kenosha. Local government is what does the things that makes all of our lives better. And the parks, certainly number one on that list. Rob's going to talk about parks funding and the shared revenue changes that occurred just this past year through legislation that was negotiated, surprisingly, in a bipartisan fashion. Whoever would have thought of such a thing in Wisconsin, but they actually got it done. Again, a ray of hope. But I want to start with today talking about President Trump's former White House physician, Ronnie Jackson. This reporting came out today in the Washington Post. You're probably not going to hear about it anywhere else because it's one of those things that's getting buried in all of the big headline-making news, the State of the Union, which, guess who's going to be hosting that on Civic Media this evening, coverage starting at 8 p.m. Yours truly, Maggie Dawn, on the line with Stuart J. Waddles, newscaster extraordinaire here in southeastern Wisconsin for the Civic Media Radio Network. Do not miss it. I will be lighting it up in a much more exciting way than you will ever hear on any of the networks. You know me. And this is one for the ages, folks. This State of the Union, holy cow. I can't think of a State of the Union that will come anywhere near as close to as important as this one, either past or going into the future. This is it. And it's going to be wild. If you thought Marjorie Taylor Greene and her Cruella de Vil faux fur white jacket last year was something shouting at the president, I can't imagine what's about to go down during this State of the Union. You're not going to want to miss a minute of it. Tune in here on your favorite Civic Media radio station. I'll be joined by Stuart J. Waddles for that coverage starting at 8. But getting back to Ronnie Jackson. Lest any of us have forgotten. Ronny Jackson is the guy who said that the then 71-year-old president could, quote, live to be 200 years old. I think, Anya, do you have some crazy Ronny Jackson quotes? Because this stuff's pretty fun.
His regimen. He has a history of elevated cholesterol and is currently on a low dose of Crestor. All clinical data indicates that the president is currently very healthy and that he will remain so for the duration of his presidency. He would like to lose over the next, I think a reasonable goal over the next year or so is to lose 10 to 15 pounds. Picked one of the ones that was a little bit more involved. It was longer. It was the more difficult one of all of them. It took significantly longer to complete, but the president did exceedingly well on it. So that was not driven at all by any clinical concerns I have. It was driven by the president's wishes, and he did well on it. The fact that the president got, 30 out of 30 on that exam, I think that,
Diet Cokes and who never exercises is in as good a shape as you say he's in.
It's called genetics. I don't know. It's some people have, just great genes. I told the president that if he had a healthier diet over the last 20 years, he might live to be 200 years old. I don't know. I mean, he...
Say what? Okay, couple of things there. He needs to lose, just 10 to 15 pounds. Donald Trump could not ride a bicycle. I mean, if we were doing TV news right now, I'd be showing you a picture of Joe Biden tooling around on his bike. Donald Trump trying to waddle into a golf cart. 10 to 15, add a zero. The guy's easily tipping 300. Then he was talking about the cognitive test. He got 30 out of 30. This is stuff like identify the elephant. This is not, I have taken the neuropsychological exams because I had concerns that my cognition was impaired following two terrible bouts of COVID. That stuff takes like all day. I was doing visual puzzles, word associations, not pick out the elephant. It literally tells you nothing. Why is this guy over-exaggerating? And then he'll live to 100 because of his genetics. I mean, Anyways, Ronny Jackson then left the White House physician's role, was supported by Trump, ran for Congress in 2019, and won, and then won re-election again in 2022. Big fun. If you want to join the conversation, 855-75-CIVIC. Now, in all fairness, Ronny Jackson was originally selected by Barack Obama. But Barry, I mean, that man's in shape. He's playing hoops a couple of times a week. But Ronny Jackson's sort of willingness to supplicate himself and lie and exaggerate, a little icky. And then we find out today this. He is no longer a retired admiral. He has been demoted. Stripped of his admiralty. It's going to have major impacts for him in his pension that he receives from the Navy. And he was demoted in July 2022, but the news just coming out today. So this happened a long time ago. Now, what's notable here is that Ronny Jackson and Republicans continue to use his admiralty title when they talk, I'm retired Admiral Ronny Jackson, retired Rear Admiral. No, you're not. The Navy stripped that title from you. Totally inappropriate to continue to use that designation. To put it in context of being a lawyer, if I'm disbarred, I don't get to call myself a lawyer anymore. That's actually a crime. And here's what this Inspector General report concluded. He berated subordinates in the White House medical unit. He made sexual and denigrating statements about a female subordinate, consumed alcohol inappropriately with subordinates, and consumed the sleep drug Ambien while on duty as the president's physician. Yikes.
I wouldn't want to mess around with Ambien anywhere.
Booze?
And all of that sounds like a good way to really, really hurt yourself or someone else. Yeah, geez.
I mean, Ambien, booze, and a little sexual flirtation and innuendo, in the White House. I have never drank or taken a single drug even prescribed medications that would have any psychological impact while I have been working in my entire career. Never done it. I don't get that. And that's not to say, listen, I like to have a drink with my friends. I like to unwind after work. But I don't do it while I'm on duty. I can't wait to hear what CJ has to say. What's up? Hello? You there, CJ?
I am. Thank you for taking my call, Maggie. Well, you know, if the same criteria fits, we should be really concerned about President Biden.
I'm not talking about President Biden right now, CJ. This is my problem. This is why I cut you off. I'm talking about Ronny Jackson and the fact that this guy is quack material and completely unfit. And he lied basically to ingratiate himself to Donald Trump so he could run for Congress. That's why. Do you think this guy should still be calling himself a retired rear admiral when that designation was stripped from him, CJ?
When it's the Biden administration.
Oh, my God. Bye, CJ. Learn to answer a question and participate in the discussion, or we won't be having you anymore on this show. This is not okay. And by the way, this was the second Inspector General report. This guy was investigated before. There were whistleblowers. That additional report was one that came out of quote-unquote, several investigations in the wake of Jackson's tenure as the White House physician. Apparently, the unit was run, including the unit's, quote, lax controls relating to powerful drugs like Ambien and the stimulant Provigil.
I've never even heard of Provigil.
Neither have I. I mean, holy cow, and thank you, Papa Rico, texting us on Facebook, I believe. Glad we got CJ out of the way at the beginning of the show. Me too, my friend. Thank you. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm going to continue to talk about the money. Because why do you think Ronny Jackson supplicated himself? He did that. He lied about Donald Trump's health. He gave him a pick out the elephant kind of exam because he knew Trump would effectively pay him back and pay him back. Indeed, he did. He's now a sitting congressman. I'm Maggie Dawn. We'll be back with more in a moment. Join us. 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Good job with more pay and you're okay. Money, it's a gas. Grab that cash with both hands and
star daydream, think you'll buy me a football team.
What's up, Wisconsin? You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Network. Join my conversation. Help us understand. Bring your viewpoint to the table. I want to hear them as long as you're on topic. 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. Join us this afternoon. Yeah, Ronny Jackson, former White House physician, demoted after two inspector general reports, multiple investigation into myriad misconduct while he was White House physician under Trump. This dates back to Trump. He's still calling himself a retired rear admiral. He's not. He's a captain, which is a lie, which apparently is stock in trade now for the MAGA party. And just, you know, as a point of fact, why might he lie? Why might he supplicate himself? What might lead someone to drink on the job and take mind-altering medications?
Other than dealing with Trump?
No. I mean very much because you're
dealing with Trump. I see.
That might be a reason. And because Trump will do things like this. While Trump was still in office, he attempted to put Jackson into his cabinet as Secretary of Veterans Affairs. That nomination failed, led to one whistleblower complaint. He also twice nominated Jackson to become a two-star admiral, although those nominations stalled as well. And of course, what is retired Captain Ronny Jackson now doing as a congressman? Running around talking about Joe Biden's mental health. Listen, I am not going to ever accept the argument that Joe Biden is not mentally fit. CJ, go So he's stumbled. So he stumbles over words. Trump doesn't even know who he's running against half of the time. And listen, even if I were to accept, for argument's sake, the assertion that Biden has some cognitive impairment, the response is, so does Trump, and one is dangerous and one isn't when it comes to foreign policy, the handling of wars and conflicts. Again, I don't think Trump could find Israel on a map. We also don't track hurricanes by using a Sharpie over the Gulf of Mexico. Again, one is a menace to our American way of life and our national security. One is not. But I firmly reject the premise that Biden is cognitively impaired in such a way that would hinder his ability to do the job. Mike from La Crosse, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm so happy I found your radio show, Maggie. You're stuck with me for a long time. So,
thank you. Anyway, I love it. Thank you, Mike.
Well, as somebody who has recognized, I think most Americans have recognized that we're in a disinformation age today. We, we're in a group, or in an era, I should say, where influencing is the role of media, not reporting the news. And right, knowing that, and CJ sounds like he's a pretty smart guy, wouldn't a prudent person, once you hear that this Trump's doctor start talking in terms of 200 years, wouldn't you suddenly do a, isn't that like an aha moment that, there's someone's barking up the wrong tree a little bit?
Or at least trying too hard. Thanks so much, Mike, for the call. I really appreciate you listening. Tell all your friends where we make sense of the nonsense and bring some common sense to all of this chaos. That's what we're trying to do here together on the Maggie Dawn Show. The elevation or the preferencing, and now the complete demand from Donald Trump that everyone swear fealty to him, has taken over the entire Republican Party. It's not the Republican Party anymore. It's the MAGA Party. It's the party of Donald Trump. We're going to see that tonight during the State of the Union. My coverage with Stuart J. Waddles begins at 8 p.m. You're not going to want to miss it because I won't do it like everybody else does it. It won't be yawn. I'll be giving you real color commentary, if you know what I'm saying. But this elevation of fealty, this denigration of science, this denial of facts, the refusal to call out the absurd, that's the brand now. The gaslighting, the lying, the self-promotion, that's the brand. That's what they're selling. And what I worry about when folks spit back the faux news talking points to me is, man, you are turning over your wallet, your mind, and your heart to these hucksters. And that worries me. It worries me not just for our country, but for each and every one of those individuals who I believe want good things for them, their families, and their neighbors. But they're being tricked, bamboozled, fooled, and lied to. This guy, Ronnie Jackson, seems to be of one mold when it comes to doctors affiliated with the MAGA party. Because, of course, what's happening back in Florida, I talked about it, I think, on my first show last Monday. You can get the old episodes at civicmedia.us. Talked about Surgeon General from Florida, Ladapo. And it is all about the money. Guess, I'll just give you a guess, Anya. How much do you think the Surgeon General of Florida, the nation's third largest state, is making to basically question measles vaccines, to refuse to put out a stay-at-home directive as measles rips through Broward County and may kill children? How much do you think that guy's making?
Well, based on what you've just said, his job is, I'd hope, like $0. but if I were to give a real number, I'll guess $120,000 a year. Please tell me it's lower than that.
So Anya says $120,000. Mark from Prairie du Sac, how much do you think Surgeon General Ladapo is making?
Oh, God, I think I saw that. It's far higher than that $100,000 mark. than if I remember. Like, I've never seen it, and just gagging when I think I saw it.
So that's what Mark says, it's gag-inducing. Stephen from Green Bay, how much do you think Surgeon General Ladapo is making in Florida?
Oh, probably upwards of $300,000 a year.
All right. Oh, no. So we got 120, we got gag-inducing, we got upwards of 320. The number is $600,000 a year. I think Anya's actually getting physically sick. If you want to watch Anya get
angry. Right, so angry.
If you want to watch us get physically sick, because the Surgeon General, who's going to cost and has cost Floridian lives, the lives of children, you can always watch us on YouTube and Facebook. Yeah, I mean, what? What? Here's what, this is the quote. I mean, this guy says it far better than I even could. This is Dr. Robert Speth, a professor of pharmaceutical studies at South Florida's Nova Southeastern University, with more than four decades of research experience. Here's what he said about Surgeon General Ladapo raking in a measly $600K of the good taxpayers of Florida money. The Surgeon General is Ron DeSantis's lapdog and says whatever DeSantis wants him to say. His statements are more political than medical, and that's a horrible disservice to the citizens of Florida who are paying his salary. He's somebody whose job it is to protect public health, and he's doing the exact opposite. It is always all about the money. Keep it locked. We're going to talk more about the money here in the state of Wisconsin with my good friend, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Public Policy Foundation, Rob Henkin, coming up in just a minute. Again, from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, you're not... What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Today's episode, all about the money, honey. We're joined by a special guest. I'm going to bring him on in just a second. Wanted to shout out some of the folks watching on Facebook and YouTube. Papa Rico putting in a guess for how much the anti-science Florida Surgeon General makes a year, $350,000 close. But the prize today goes to Sherry Manazzi, guessing $500K, just $100K short. Sherry, yes, Surgeon General Ladapo helping to spread measles and potentially kill kids across Broward County.
For the low, low price?
$600,000 of those taxpayer dollars in Florida. Most excellent. But enough about those sad, sad stories. I would like to bring on my guest, the executive director of Wisconsin's Policy Forum, Rob Henkin. Welcome, Rob. Thanks for making time.
Well, thanks for having me, Maggie.
Wonderful to have you here. Let's start with the basics. What is the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and why should it matter to every Wisconsinite?
So the first of all, you can hear me now, correct?
I can. Thank you.
All right. So the Wisconsin Policy Forum is a fiercely nonpartisan, nonprofit public policy research organization. Long way of saying we're a public policy think tank. We cover state and local government, fiscal policy, economic development, education, and social services are our main areas of research. But we really touch virtually all areas of public policy. Also cover school district finance throughout the state of Wisconsin. We've been around, believe it or not, for over 100 years. We were formed as a Bureau of Municipal Efficiency all the way back in 1913 in the city of Milwaukee. That was the progressive era. It was an era when muckraking journalists were starting to uncover graft and corruption. In the halls of city government, the famous Tammany Hall corruption story in New York City was top of mind. And Milwaukee was actually one of a half dozen cities across the United States where business and civic leaders got together to form bureaus of municipal efficiency to serve as another sort of set of eyes and ears over the workings of city government, but also to do research and analysis that was designed to hopefully promote more efficient and effective government in cities where these bureaus were established. So over time, we expanded, our coverage expanded not only or beyond the city of Milwaukee to Milwaukee County and eventually to the seven counties, Southeast Wisconsin region. We sort of morphed from being a government watchdog to a policy think tank. We started to incorporate many different policy areas beyond government finance. And then a big development in our history occurred in 2018 when the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum, which was our had been our name since about 1987, we merged with the Madison-based Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance and became the Wisconsin Policy Forum. And we now have offices in both Madison and Milwaukee and cover the entire state.
One of the things I love about the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob, and the work that you and the incredible researchers and analysts at the WPF do is that you really provide what I think is readable, accessible, and understandable analyses of the most important issues for local and state government across the state of Wisconsin. It's not just about Milwaukee, though we will talk about Milwaukee Parks a bit today. It's not just about Madison. And the fact that the WPF is fiercely, as you put it, nonpartisan. No one comes to the table with preordained outcomes that they jam the data to make fit. And that is so critical. So I want to begin with just an incredible amount of thanks. I have been reading data and research that has come out of the Policy Forum since my time in high school in the early 90s in the city of Milwaukee, because I used so much of the research to help me with various papers or assignments that I engaged with. It's really a treasure for the state of Wisconsin to have the Policy Forum. Where can people find the Policy Forum and access some of the research papers that you do? And by the way, folks, if you pull up one of the WPF's papers and you go, oh my gosh, it's 30 pages long. Do not worry, friends. Do not fret. They always come with a very helpful executive summary at the front end. So if you only have a few minutes of time, you can just read that. Where can they find your work, Rob?
So our website is wispolicyforum.org. And we work very hard to ensure that any research that we put out there is accessible to the general public. So you do not have to pay a dime. You do not have to be a member of our organization. If any of your listeners would care to consider becoming members of our organization, we would gladly appreciate that. But no, we think it's very important that anyone, if they happen to be, as you said, a high school student or a college student doing a research project on a certain topic, if our research can be helpful, that's great. Clearly, we want all policymakers throughout the state, whether that's elected officials or even people who serve on planning boards or other, you know, types of governmental entities. If our work can help inform, that's what we're here for.
And that's so critical. And most think tanks are not nonpartisan. They have a slant of some variety. And the Wisconsin Policy Forum, especially as a state and local government focused think tank that is nonpartisan, that does not allow itself to be co-opted by a particular party. Y'all are now pretty unique, aren't you, within the United States? There's very few states that have a resource like the Policy Forum.
Yeah, I'd say we are. We're members of a national group called the Governmental Research Association. There's about two dozen of us, but even some of those, they're taxpayer foundation types of groups, which tend to skew right. Some have only five or six different primary funders. And if those happen to be corporations, whether rightly or wrongly, there may be an assumption that they skew conservative. Conversely, if maybe there's a liberal foundation that is the biggest funder by far, in which case maybe there's that perception. So we are relatively unique. We have a very diverse set of funders. We're, as I said, we're a membership organization. We have over 250 dues-paying members, and we work very hard to make sure that that is a diverse group, that it's, again, if those were mostly corporations, there might be a perception of the way we lean. If those were mostly governments or even academic institutions, maybe there'd be a perception we lead the other way. So we have a pretty equal mix of individuals, corporations, universities, local governments, and school districts themselves, and we want to keep it that way.
Well, again, my thanks to you and everyone that works at the Policy Forum. Your work is invaluable to the state of Wisconsin and invaluable to our decisions, our voting, and our policymakers. With that, let's jump into what I think statewide has been one of the biggest challenges for all local governments, rural, urban, sort of in between jurisdictions, whether you have predominantly, again, agricultural products or industry as your predominant economic driver within your jurisdiction, or sort of the diverse, manifold industries that you see in a Dane or Milwaukee County. And that was the funding of local government. Can you, Rob, explain to people who may not have been familiar with what, quote, shared revenue is? What is shared revenue, and why does it matter so much to local government?
Yep. Well, shared revenue, I'll give you the explanation, but let me start by just saying it matters a lot more in this state than it does in others because of the way we have set up our system for funding our local governments, both counties as well as municipalities, which are defined as cities, villages, and towns. So you have to go all the way back to 1911 is the beginning of this story, and I won't tell a century-old story here, but we were, I believe, the first state in the nation to have a state income tax. And when our forefathers here in Wisconsin state government decided to implement a state income tax, they also decided at that time to vest that authority squarely with the state. So in saying the state was going to have an income tax, they made it clear that local units of government were not going to be able to pursue that form of taxation. And in doing so, the bargain that they made with those local governments was that we, the state, will collect income taxes and we will commit to sharing a portion of our income tax collections with our units of government to make up for the fact that we're not going to allow them to pursue that revenue source.
Ah, that's why it's called, quote, shared revenue.
Yes. Precisely. We are sharing the proceeds of this form of taxation that we are holding to ourselves. And the same principle essentially followed a couple decades later when the state did a sales tax. In this case, there was an exception in that counties, actually several decades after that, in the early 1990s, the state allowed counties to levy sales taxes of up to a half cent. But same principle. State said, look, we're going to be the one to levy sales taxes, but we'll share those proceeds. And that system worked okay for a very long time. But due to a variety of factors, starting in the mid-1990s, state government essentially decided to freeze the shared revenue program. So no longer were the proceeds shared in a roughly proportional basis with local units of government, as the state's own sales and income tax collections grew, but it essentially turned into a budgetary appropriation. And because of other priorities, including at the time a commitment to fund 2/3 of the costs of local schools, corrections costs, Medicaid costs, all sorts of other priorities, that shared revenue appropriation never went up. Since the mid-1990s. So here we had created a system where we said to our local units of government, we the state, look, we're going to reserve for ourselves two of the three primary forms of taxation, sales and income. We're going to let you do property taxes, but that's it. And we're also going to be restrictive on fees, by the way. And so we're going to make you heavily reliant on shared revenues from the state and on property taxes. Yet starting in the mid-1990s, they said, but we're going to share, we're going to freeze the shared revenue appropriation. And then starting in 2006, they said, we are going to put very restrictive limits on the ability of local governments to increase property taxes from year to year. So that's what was really starting to fall apart, because, you know, you don't have to be Alan Greenspan to recognize that if you say to an entity, whether it's a public or a private entity, your two primary sources of revenue are never going to grow, or at least not come close to growing with inflation, then that's going to have an impact on how much they can spend.
Yeah, there's going to be...
if you are of a mind that they were spending too much, that might be okay for maybe the first few years. But for two decades, or three decades in the case of shared revenues, that really started to cause some very big problems, particularly among larger cities in the state who, because of the shared revenue formula, were most reliant on shared revenue.
For folks at home, to summarize, imagine your wages were frozen in the mid-1990s and didn't ever go up. Could you make ends meet? I think not. Rob Henkin just broke down the shared revenue crisis that has been plaguing municipalities in the state of Wisconsin for some at least 15 plus years. We're going to have more with Rob when we come back after these really important messages. We're going to get into the solution, or maybe partial solution, that got passed this past year in a bipartisan fashion out of the state of Wisconsin. Keep it locked, everybody. More coming up next with Rob Henkin, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, here on The Maggie Dawn Show.
My life turned upside down. Chicks that blew your mind, ding, it's the second round. Original track and ding, you know you can't buy these things. Can you feel that? Yeah, we're paying with love tonight. It's not about the money.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show, joined this hour by Rob Henkin, the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Wisconsin's nonpartisan public policy think tank that helps all of us, each and every one of us, taxpayers and residents, as well as all of our elected officials, understand some of the most important questions that face local and state government. Thanks again, Rob, for joining us here on The Maggie Dawn Show. For all you folks that are listening, there's a big ticket, both in terms of price and the importance of the issue, question coming up in Milwaukee in this April-spring election cycle. Election day is April 2nd. There's going to be a critical referendum on the ballot asking for over $200 million in funding for Milwaukee public schools. I'm going to invite Rob back to join me. I know we've got a regular cadence of appearances set up, but I want to be sure people have an opportunity to hear from you and the forum, Rob, before the election. So we're going to sort out a date before the election to talk about the referendum. So everybody, if you think Rob is as awesome to talk to as I do, and Kurt, sorry I missed you. I saw you on the call line. Call back if you want to ask Rob a question. 855-75-CIVIC. We will have Rob on to specifically talk about the MPS referendum. You and I will figure that date out offline, Rob. I'm excited to host that discussion because you all have a report coming out this next week, don't you?
Yep. We actually will be publishing a report this coming Monday. We're just going to be laying out in as factual a basis as possible the various considerations, giving readers a perspective on an MPS's financial situation in layman's terms that hopefully will be informative to them as they get ready to cast a very important vote. It's a very big ask coming from MPS leaders, particularly on top of the new 2% city sales tax. On the other hand, Milwaukee Public Schools, like local governments throughout the state of Wisconsin, has been dealt a hand in terms of what it can do with regard to its revenue structure that is a very difficult one to play.
You can find that report this coming Monday about the MPS funding referendum that will be on the April 2nd ballot by going to wisconsinpolicyforum.org. Check it out. We'll have Rob back. We'll talk about that. But today we are talking about the the mathematical impossibility of local government that sort of got set in motion going back over a century, that the state reserved to itself exclusively both sales tax and income tax, with a tiny exception for counties in the 1990s, as well as most fees. So effectively told local governments, you cannot independently decide to raise revenues. You can only do and raise the revenues that we tell you you may, and that was property tax. And that had very severe limits on whether or not property taxes could be increased going back to the 90s. So it set up a situation where we've got the cost of providing the same level of government services going up. And I know you're going to put some detail to that, Rob. While state shared revenue, in other words, the amount of income taxes that municipalities would collect and send to the state, the amount of that was then shared back with that individual municipality or county, was effectively going down because it didn't even keep up with the rate of inflation. So you ended up in these recent years with what most of us referred to as a fiscal cliff. Can you add a little bit more detail about what exactly was going on there with cost of government going up to provide just the same sort of basic services that all of us expect and deserve from our local governments, while the amount of revenue that we had to provide those services in effect going down?
Yep. So first of all, I'm going to have to generalize, because really, in some respects, to answer that question, you'd have to go municipality by municipality. Right. And as I mentioned before the break, the set of governments that tended to be suffering most were larger city governments, not only city of Milwaukee, but if we look at the other nine largest cities, because the way the shared revenue structure was set up, the formula favored, in this case, did take into account issues like poverty, and the extent of your property tax base, et cetera. So, what happened is, with regards to the property tax levy, the levy limits said that you can increase your levy based on the amount of net new construction you got within your community from year to year. I won't get into the weeds on that, but
everyone's saying thank you very much for saving us the weeds on net new construction within a municipality.
Yes, yes. Nobody wants to hear that dissertation. But suffice it to say that growing communities at least had some additional wherewithal to at least increase their property tax levies. And I'm not trying to put a value judgment behind that, but just to say, in terms of keeping up with their needs, to increase their levies to approach those needs, whereas communities that weren't growing very much didn't. So a lot of them had double whammies, not growing very much, large cities that were really reliant on shared revenue, which wasn't growing at all. And that's a problem even if your costs are just growing at inflation. But think about things like police and fire and emergency medical services. Fire departments, they have big capital needs. And the cost of a ladder truck today is like $1.5 million. It was about $600,000 a decade ago. And
I want to emphasize that a single ladder truck for a fire department costs $1.5 million, one truck. And we haven't hired a person. And we haven't paid a single one of them a minute of overtime. Go ahead, Rob.
Yep. Well, and we could get into a long discussion, Maggie, about, well, does every community really need a fire truck? Mm-hmm. A ladder truck. And
yes,
we've done a lot of work on looking at fire department consolidation, but that's another story. But back to this one. Another element here is that Wisconsin Act 10, which, again, we could have a long discussion about, and I'm not professing either support or opposition, but it exempted public safety unions. And so some might agree with that. People who are risking their lives every day, do they deserve to be able to bargain for their annual pay increases versus not? And again, I'm not meaning to say that these public sector employees deserve to have collective bargaining more than any others. But
we're going to have to take... we're going to have to take a quick break, but I think the point you're making, Rob, is that the cost related to those bargained for critically important public safety services continued to go up exponentially. And so we were faced again with decreasing on an inflation adjusted basis revenues, and for many critical public safety services, quickly increasing costs. We're going to take the news, the weather, and sports. We're going to come back with Rob Henken because the now what part, the what do we do about this, so critically important. And we've got at least some sort of a partial solution that came through in 2023. Keep it locked. I'm Maggie Dawn with Rob Henken, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. More after the news, sports, and weather at the top of the hour.